Okay. Next, now I don't. The next our case is not being argued. United States versus Peterson, correct? So move on to United States versus Blackwell.
Wait a minute. Apparently, we have the Peterson people here.
Peterson. Oh, well, we've been given a note saying this was being submitted without argument. Is that incorrect?
There was a co-defendant on that. There was Peterson and Larry Ellis. Ellis is being submitted on the briefs because.
Oh, I see. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, so are you, Mr. Rosen?
I am.
Okay, so let's see. I'm misunderstood.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Mark Rosen appears on behalf of Defendant Appellant Larry Peterson. We presented two issues in our briefs. Basically, the first issue was whether or not my client's statement that he gave to the police was voluntary and coerced, and the second issue we presented was whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in denying his request for an evidentiary hearing to consider whether or not he should be allowed to withdraw his pleas. It's our position that the trial court did abuse its discretion. It's our position that Mr. Peterson did not provide a knowing and voluntarily intelligent pleas because his trial counsel misrepresented to him and we raised enough issues in our motion hearing pleadings that he was advised unequivocally that he was going to get a concurrent sentence to a state sentence, which would affect the total penalty that was advised. That would have been
what in the record shows that he was so advised.
What was in the record, Your Honor, is the fact that we presented motion here pleadings in which is supported by an affidavit.
An affidavit of whom?
That was my affidavit based upon information.
You neither gave nor received that advice, right?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
You neither gave nor received that advice, correct?
No, that was not me. I was successor counsel to trial counsel.
Then it's hearsay.
It is.
And therefore counts for beans. What in the record shows that such advice was given? The district court made this observation. District court said there's no affidavit from the defendant, which is essential. The district court also pointed out that this question was addressed substantively in the plea colloquy. The possibility of a concurrent sentence was addressed. The judge said it wasn't guaranteed. And the defendant took to his feet and said, I know that.
I agree that that's...
So your whole brief is premised on there being evidence that your client committed perjury in open court when pleading guilty. But your client's not willing to say that himself. So why in the world should we pay any attention to what you say?
Because, Your Honor, this court in United States versus Galbraith decided that an affidavit based upon hearsay presented by trial counsel was sufficient to raise an issue for evidentiary hearing. And that is something that I did present that is... valid case law before the Seventh Circuit. It stated that a hearsay affidavit by trial counsel was sufficient to raise an evidentiary issue. My affidavit was also presented on information and belief.
An affidavit by counsel, after the district court has said he wants to hear directly from the defendant hasn't said anything, an affidavit by counsel can contradict what his own client said under oath in open court. And that creates an evidentiary hearing?
The thing is that Mr. Peterson was misunderstood and did not understand what was fully advised about him at open court.
How do we know that? We don't have... You know, we've said more often than I care to think that defendants who say something in open court, in a plea colloquy, can't take it back later. They can't say, the reason why I'm entitled to relief now is that I was committing perjury then. At a minimum, you would expect the defendant would submit his own affidavit and subject himself to the perjury prosecution so we could test which time he was telling the truth.
And that could be done through an evidentiary hearing. I think the issue that we would need to get to is to my right, client's right to get that evidentiary hearing. And I think based upon Galbraith, which did allow a hearsay affidavit from trial counsel, that was sufficient to get to that evidentiary hearing where we then, Mr. Peterson, excuse me, would then be tested under oath to determine whether or not he was able to get to be able to commit perjury, which would be subject to cross-examination by esteemed counsel or his successor or somebody else from his office and possibly from the court. But we did not even get to that level, and that's the point that I think is clear before this court. that my client, Rule 11 clearly indicates that he has to understand the penalties and understand what is possibly before him. And when he is told by his counsel it will be concurrent, and then he basically says yes when it's through a long series of talking by both the court and counsel, after he's told it will be concurrent, we then present an affidavit which Galbraith says is sufficient to get to the evidentiary hearing stage. And what happens at the evidentiary hearing stage is something different. But to get to that stage is something that we have raised as clearly as before this court. I think that that is something that has happened to get to the evidentiary hearing. That's why I think that the trial court abused its discretion in denying my client's right to get to the to that. I think also that my client was basically misinformed. I think there's some clear ABA standards and some clear law about my client's not being misinformed by his trial counsel about the strength of the state's case, the government's case, where he was basically not told about certain impeachable evidence, Giglio material that was present, and basically it was not a knowing and voluntary plea that was provided at that time. I think that that's something that's also warrants an evidentiary hearing. Like I indicated, I think that basically his inability to understand the charges, I think Underwood has clearly stated that, is sufficient to get to an evidentiary hearing. And I think that what would happen at that stage is something totally, completely that we would have to possibly raise, maybe won't have to raise, because maybe there will be enough there for the court to decide that there is a fair and just reason for my client to be allowed to withdraw his plea based upon trial counsel's ineffective assistance of counsel. But we aren't even at that stage yet. And I think that the trial court did abuse its discretion in not allowing my client to withdraw his pleas. As far as the first issue was concerned, basically my client's issue that he was basically coerced into giving the statement, I think that is clear on its face. He was basically a very beaten down man, crying in tears, and was basically interrogated for 50 minutes, as the trial court did indicate, prior to being read as Miranda rights. And I think that's source. I know in Siebert there was the issue where a statement was actually taken, but I think basically you have the issue of coercion in both of those cases that is present here, and I think that basically raises the issue that my client, the trial court, did not also abuse his discretion in denying my client's motion to suppress his statement. I will save my time for rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rosen. Mr. Washington?
May it please the court, my name is Melvin K. Washington. I'm appearing for the plaintiff in this matter, United States of America. The United States respectfully asks that this court affirm the decision of the district court in denying the defendant's motion to suppress the statement that was provided to him or given by him to the law enforcement officers following his arrest. And the United States also respectfully asks this court to affirm the district court's decision denying the defendant's motion to withdraw his guilty plea. I commence my argument, Your Honors, with the point that was raised and the issue that was raised by Justice Easterbrook earlier with counsel for the defendant regarding the affidavit that was submitted by the defendant in support of his motion to withdraw his guilty plea. The record is undisputed that the affidavit that Mr. Hayes filed was not disputed by any other statement under oath submitted to the district court in this case, and hence the trial court was justified in finding that the defendant has not met his burden and did not meet his burden that would have enabled the court to justify and to allow him to withdraw his guilty plea. Let's look at the facts that took place in this case. After numerous postponements of the trial in this case, after three lawyers had been appointed to represent him, he enters a plea on the 20th of January, 2004. What happens 4 days later? 4 days after the plea is entered, and after the district court had denied his request to be released on bail pending sentencing, and also advised him that the court will make the determination as to whether or not he will be allowed to be released on bail pending an appeal, the defendant files a letter with the district court asking to have a new attorney appointed to represent him. And he goes forth with a litany of other matters that he raises with the district court, none of which have been raised in the district court before his plea was entered. He claims that he might be eligible for a 5K1, that his lawyer had told him that. Somewhere along the line in the course of this appeal, he dropped that argument entirely. He also contended on the Giglio, he was entitled to show a jury the deals that the co-defendants received I believe the record in this case indicates, and I think counsel has in his brief submitted to this court, indicated that Mr. Hayes had the materials relating to the co-defendants in the case. So why, during the course of the change of plea, did the defendant not raise the issue with the district court as to whether or not there were some facts that he didn't have? Indeed, in the district court's colloquy with the defendant acknowledged that the issues with respect to statements or evidence concerning Mr. Willis would not be pursued. That issue would not be pursued, and it will fall by the wayside, and it will be waived. Consequently, we know that that was not an issue that the district court was justified in finding was a basis for the defendant's withdrawal of his plea. But he also says to the district court that he didn't know that he could get consecutive prison time on his state and federal cases. I think that in the colloquy between Justice Easterbrook and Mr. Cohen, this
last time I looked, judges of this court are called judges.
Judge Easterbrook.
You just wanted to promote him just because you know there's a vacancy, but go ahead.
I'm honored to hear that, Judge. Thank you. The district court engaged in a colloquy with the defendant with respect to whether or not his sentence in federal court would be made consecutive.
Are you familiar with this case, Galbraith, that your opponent cited or mentioned to us? It's not cited in the briefs.
No, I'm not, Your Honor. But I don't find that the cases that have been referenced and briefed in this case supports the argument that the defendant is entitled to get a hearing at which time he is supposed to and would be entitled to bring forth those issues that he now wants to bring forth and wants this court to order the district court to permit him to assert.
Let me ask you about this other issue, the 45-minute speech that the police gave this fellow before giving him the Miranda warnings. Well, what's the purpose of that?
Your Honor, I believe that the record indicates in the case that the officer explained to the defendant that he wanted him to remain silent, not ask any questions at all, but that he wanted to for the defendant to hear the evidence that the officer had mounted against him in that case. The indication was that the officer had
That's
interviewed.
Fine, but why not give him his Miranda warning first?
Because the officer had not commenced a custodial interrogation, Your Honor. In this particular case, the defendant relies on Siebert for the argument that the defendant was deprived of his constitutional rights and Fifth Amendment rights because the officer hadn't given him his Miranda warnings. But Miranda applies to custodial interrogation, not to statements given by a police officer to an individual at the commencement of the contact between the two.
Except for the Christian Bale speech one, which was in, if I recall correctly, he said it was a way of convincing the defendant to plead guilty or to make a statement because it would provoke his conscience to do so.
Yes, I believe that is true. That in
the Isaacs case said that if you're just making conversation, it doesn't make any difference.
Your Honor, I think in that case, in Brewer, the court did find that that was an impermissible procedure on behalf of the law enforcement officer.
Right.
But this case here,
but they said that's why they did it. But that's why I think Judge Posner's question is pertinent. Why was the speech? Why the speech?
Your Honor, that's a procedure that was used by the law enforcement officer.
I understand, but why? What's the purpose?
I believe, Judge, he did it because that was the methodology. I don't think that police officers are obligated to follow a precise set routine in terms of their interaction with defendants or suspects, for that matter.
I know. All I have to do is follow the law, but I want to know why the long speech.
I think, Judge, in this case, what had happened was the case had gone on for quite some time. The robbery took place in January, I believe, of 2001, and this defendant was arrested in October.
So he's going to do him a favor and recite what he's discovered.
Well, I think it's interesting that you use that statement, Judge, because I think that the defendant had more information than perhaps most defendants have in deciding whether or not they're going to make a statement to law enforcement officers.
Hmm.
The officer gave him that information. And I think that it enabled the defendant to make
an intelligent decision.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it does.
Mm.
And in this particular case, the officer did not engage in coercive action.
But the unreality of it is, he makes the speech as a prelude to the interrogation. So the person knows he's going to be questioned, right? I mean, that's the whole purpose. What would be the purpose? Just making a speech to a person, saying, now go back to your cell, or what? That wouldn't make any sense, right? It's a prelude. After the prelude, he did give the first stage in the interrogation.
He did give the Miranda warning between the prelude and the question, didn't he?
That is correct, Your Honor. He did. And in fact, the district court found that the events were separate and distinct, although the district court made the determination that the speech, as someone has referred to it here, constituted interrogation. The United States disputes that characterization. But in this particular case, the district court found, however, that the warning that was given to the defendant after the statement was made to him by the law enforcement officer, that that Miranda warning was sufficient, and that the defendant's statement thereafter was the product of a rational determination on the part of the defendant to make that statement and to give that confession. I see that my time is up.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Washington.
Thank you.
Mr. Rosen, how much time does he have? 2-3 minutes? Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honors. A couple of quick points that I wanted to rebut on. Galbraith is cited in the decision and order of the trial court denying the motion to withdraw the...
Yeah, I've just read it. The court said in that case that the defendant had not presented any affidavit and therefore was not entitled to an evidentiary hearing. It most assuredly did not hold that an affidavit from counsel relaying hearsay observations of the defendant could contradict the defendant's statements made in open court.
The trial court, that case at the very last page, the very last paragraph, does indicate that had there been any sort of an affidavit, even an affidavit by trial counsel presented by hearsay,
You read Galbraith?
Yes, I have, Your Honor.
We didn't say that. I just read it. We remarked in passing that there had not been in that case any affidavit from either the defendant or his counsel. We did not say that a lawyer could relay hearsay contradicting statements made in open court, which is what you need in this case. We didn't even say it, let alone hold it, because there hadn't been any affidavit in Galbraith.
Correct.
Is there any case that has a holding on which you might seek to rely here?
Not to my knowledge. I did read a line from Galbraith about to that effect.
Read one line from it. It's always good to read.
No, I did read. I did read. As far as the custodial interrogation issue, Your Honors, I think that there was an issue. The trial court, as Mr. Washington did say, did find that the prelude, so to speak, prior to the actual provision of the Miranda warnings was a custodial interrogation, and I think that that is true, and I think that that is correct. I think that Mr. Washington indicating that he is disputing that that was part of the interrogation. Vera saying they made a correct decision at the end. Trial court made a correct decision, and I don't think he can pick and choose what he wishes to rely upon and not rely upon. I'm out of time. Thank you very much, Tom.
Okay, thank you. And you were appointed, were you not? Well, we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client. Next case for argument is United States versus